It's Thursday, February 14th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 291 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 53 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is John.
And joining us today, we've got three folks. And actually, John's kind of one of the interview guests as well. But we've got three other interview guests here doing a little bit of an extended round table. So first off, we have Chuck Wills.
Hi there.
Then we've got Joel.
Hello.
And Tristan.
Good morning, everybody.
All right. Now, you may be wondering who the heck these people are. So let's back up and set up what we're doing on this show. And then we will back up and let each of these people kind of give their resume and explain who they are. There's a particular interview show, a roundtable show I've been wanting to do for a while, which I am calling Going From Zero to Published. What I want to talk about is new authors who have very recently gone from zero to published. They took an idea, they wrote it, they got it out there. And I wanted to go after new authors because of the fact that, one, I feel like the fact that these people have done it, that they've gone from nothing or next to nothing to being published, it kind of gives anyone out there a sense of what a plausible way forward is. You know, you're not going to be the next Stephen King, but you just want to get something written. Here's an attainable path to success. And secondly, while we've had people who are established authors on the show, and we could probably land more, what they're going to give you is a really, really interesting story about something that happened 20, 30, 40 years ago. And this is an industry that has changed radically in the past 2, 3, and 4 years. So I think to give you guys information on how to break in decades ago would do nothing to speak to what it is like to break into an industry where things like Lulu and Amazon are major players. And so I wanted to talk to people who really had a perspective on how to leverage those tools. We're not just going to talk about the technical side, though. We're also going to talk about the creative side, how they got over their hurdles, how they got over their writer's block, how they got themselves to stop editing to death. But these are all the things we're going to talk about. So first, let me back up and explain who these people are. Now, John, obviously the listeners know who you are.
I think so.
But you just put out Blood Moon Goblins.
That is correct. I just put out a small campaign setting / guided adventure tour thing for Pathfinder called Blood Moon Goblins, in which the gag is that you play goblin player characters and have to fight off other sections of the goblin tribe, clawing your way upward if you so dare, while you are under constant attack from basically the whole rest of the Monstrous Manual menagerie and most of the Player's Handbook menagerie, so you really have no friends. And it's sort of a hard mode, Johnny G, haha, they died because they got hit by a house cat type of game that starts from that point, but then can evolve into a real game with real characters and real plot arcs if you choose to pick it up and run with it. So that's Blood Moon Goblins.
And you can find that either at bloodmoongoblins.com, or you can also find it both on Paizo's site through their storefront, the Pathfinder storefrant, or you can find it on DriveThruRPG. So
that's correct. And if we get to distribution later, I'll go more into that, but I'm distributing on both DriveThru and Paizo.
Right. Okay. So Chuck, let's move to you next. What have you done? People are involved in our forum community know you, but they know you under a different name.
That's right. They know me as Aaron Stack or any of the other random nicknames that I give myself. What I put out is called Chronicles of Spire Rebellion. It is a fantasy short story collection set in a universe of my own creation. 4 short stories and then kind of an epilogue, kind of capstone short story. It shares characters across each of the stories, but it focuses on an individual character with each kind of chapter, each tale. I basically got the idea a long time ago that, you know, I liked a lot of different fantasy tropes and things, but I didn't like the way that they were being used, so I used them in different ways, in the ways that I liked to use them. It is available in print through CreateSpace and electronically through Smashwords. If you go to chroniclesofspire.com on the ordering info section, you can download it or buy it off CreateSpace there.
And by the way, for you guys at home, I hope you will at least check out these guys' websites, if not their writing. I hope you do that as well. But if you are trying to remember these URLs, don't worry about it. Like always, I'll be a good show host, and these will all be in the show notes. So if you can just remember to go to the same place you got this podcast, then you will have access to all of the relevant links to find these things. Chuck, before we move on to the final two gentlemen with us, yes, real quick, you said something I'm curious about. You said that you liked some of the fantasy tropes, but not some of the ways they were used. Since this is specific to your work and not to the topic we're discussing in general, I want to hit this now. What do you mean by that? Can you give me an example?
I'll give an example with the first section. There are a lot of fantasy stories, especially, but stories in general, where they have for example, the quote-unquote strong female character that is, by the end of the story, utterly dependent on whatever the male lead or the male secondary character is. And I kind of got sick of that, so I made a character that was not dependent in that sort of way, but is still a strong character where gender was immaterial. It kind of answers that question of a strong, independent character, but where's a thong bikini made out of plate steel and all this other stuff that's basically just made to look pretty but can't actually fight in combat. So it was just stuff like that. And if, for example, Harry Potter sort of things usually treat magic in this very limited way of, oh, it's this toy that everybody can use, and oh, if you put your mind to it, anything could be magical. And no, in this setting, magic is a hereditary disease akin to toxic waste. So it kind of takes it a more serious route and uses it in different ways, and it allows me to tell more interesting stories. At least I think they're more interesting.
Our last two guests, and I keep putting them together because they are co-authors, but I don't want to treat you guys as if you're one human being.
Little known fact, we are.
Chad and I got that treatment for about two decades of our life, where saying Chad was interchangeable saying Dan, so I know how that feels. I'll introduce you guys separately, and where your resumes overlap, so be it. So first up, we have Joel Dahlenberg. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
I'm Joel. I was a co-author with Tristan on the GM's Real World Reference, which is a collection of real-world places, cities, people, and events that would be useful in a role-playing game. And it's 160 different articles, 40 per section. Each is a little over a page.
I thought you were about to say $160.
And... No. It's on sale.
They wish.
It's worse than Tullus.
It's on sale at DriveThruRPG for $12, in fact. And so you can take a look. Unfortunately, it's only available in PDF. But to be honest, Tristan was really the leader on this project. He was the one who had the idea, set up a lot of the work with Kickstarter. But we were certainly co-authors on it, and I will let Tristan continue.
Okay, so let's move over to our final guest, which is Tristan Zimmerman.
Hi, so I'm Tristan. I was a co-author on the GM's Real World Reference with Joel. And the idea behind this book is that Joel and I are both of the opinion that the best stories and settings and NPCs are often inspired by the real world. So we wrote a book that's a compilation of real world landscapes and buildings and cities and people and events suitable for the gaming table. So, you know, let's say you need a military commander. You could create a military commander NPC based on the same archetypes you've been using for 20 years, or you could have a look at some of history's most colorful generals like Lamachus or Tamiris or Guts von Berlichingen. If you need a barren wasteland rather than sending your PCs out into the deserts of Generica again, you can model their destination on the spiny thickets of Madagascar, the Pripet Marshes, or the Tenere Desert. If you need something unusual happening on the borders of the kingdom rather than just another rebellion or mysterious cult, why not have it be the exploits of the Captain of Kotnik, or the rise of Lysenkoism, or explorers searching for Prester John? The idea is that this isn't a history book, it's a reference for GMs. We know that nitty-gritty details won't translate into your game, and what you need is striking, attention-grabbing story. That's what we're trying to provide. The book, like Joel said, 160 topics, 221 pages, subjects from all over the world, all periods of history. Each topic contains all the information you need to run it at the table and none of the information you don't. Plus, each one ends with tips on how to use the subject. The overall idea is that every page will leave you saying, hey, that's pretty cool. I think I want to make an adventure around this.
Tristan, let me start by saying that I am refreshed by hearing you say something. I am not in any way, shape, or form against people delving into fantastical topics. And by that, I mean, you know, the really unusual topics, whether it's science fiction, fantasy, whatever. But I have always hated the reasoning of, I have to do it this way because it's more interesting than reality. When people say that to me, all it says to me is you don't know enough about reality. Some of the most colorful people, some of the most unbelievable events have for real occurred right here on this planet. And I am so glad to hear not only that that's your starting point, but then on top of that, you've actually taken that a step further and saying, hey, we're not just going to give you an encyclopedia, but we're going to give you tips on how to integrate this. In fact, I'll give a little pimp here on myself. There's a collection that I was invited to contribute to, which is not in publication yet, by the way. It will be in publication within the next couple months, probably sometimes toward summer, maybe early fall at the latest. But I was invited by Imre Korvis to contribute a short story to a steampunk anthology. And I don't have a really huge history in steampunk. And so the story that I chose to tell is one that's actually based on real events during the Franco-Prussian War of the 1870s. And I spent a lot of time with research material open, looking through that war, because of the fact that I found there was so much great stuff there to mine, to bring that alive. And so I love that you've carried that over to the gaming table. But Tristan, before we get off you, there's one other thing we got to mention here, which is people might recognize your voice as well.
Oh, yeah. I'm the host of the Dragonlance Canticle podcast. We are the, to the best of our knowledge, the internet's only fan podcast for the D&D setting of Dragonlance. Check us out if you feel like it. We update monthly, and some people think we're kind of cool.
And as with any of the book stuff, I will be sure to put a link to the DL Canticle and the DL Nexus and all that good stuff in the show notes. So be sure to go out and check our good buddies over there out. Now, let's get this interview rolling. Let me first observe that I think it's pretty cool we've got a good mix here because, Chuck, in your case, you did pure fiction. John, in your case, you did a role-playing source book. And Joel and Tristan, in your case, you guys did a role-playing aid. So I think there's going to be some pretty unique perspectives here on everything that went down. And let's go ahead and start with this. What motivated you guys to get started? What took you guys from, I have an idea, to I'm actually sitting in front of a word processor doing this?
I finished the original Blood Moon Goblins campaign sometime in the winter of 2010, 2011. Dan, you, of course, were there for almost all of it. I think you died right before the end, and we didn't quite fit in your replacement character. I just thought this is cool, and this hasn't been done before. I've seen Reverse Dungeon back in the second edition days. There was a complete guide to humanoids also in the second edition that I had a lot of fun reading. It was so different, and I wanted to screw around with it more. And to the best of my knowledge, continually, other than the Weeby Goblins little promotional free RPG set thing, which was released well after my own product was in development, there hasn't been anything for Pathfinder or even D&D 3.5 about playing monstrous humanoids together in a setting that is for them. I guess the sheer fact that it hadn't really been done before propelled me from these are my campaign notes to, okay, I'm going to put together a Kickstarter and commit hundreds of man hours from start through continual finish, because I'm certainly not done promoting it or interfacing with the community on it, and I probably never will be, or at least won't be for years. So sheer novelty and the thought that maybe many, many more people than just myself could enjoy this and could get 5 or 10 or 15 bucks worth of enjoyment out of it if I threw it up on the market propelled me to take the time and effort to present it professionally and distribute it for realsies.
Chuck, what about you?
Well, like I said before, I really love fantasy fiction, and you know, I just kept seeing the same sort of stories over and over and over again of, you know, oh, the hero has to go save the princess from the dragon, or, oh, there's some sort of cursed item that he's dealing with, or he's actually a vampire or something like that. I just decided to jot some notes down on a setting that wouldn't be so generic. And then the more I kind of played with that and the more kind of role playing I did and the more people I met and history that I read, the more ideas I came up with, until eventually I just kind of kept polishing and polishing and polishing the stone until I found the little tiny gemstone at the middle of it. And then once I had that core element there, that setting, then I just built up from there and just kept attaching more things onto it until I had plots and I had characters and I had all this other stuff. And it kind of grew organically, of going from building the setting to building the plots and characters, and then each one kind of supported the other in this atlas under the globe sort of way. But, I mean, this setting and all these plots and characters and stuff has been going on for a couple years now, but I think what pushed me over the edge was just really wanted to make it happen. I wanted it to be done. I wanted it to be out of my head and into somebody else's hands so that hopefully they could read my stuff in the same way I've read read all sorts of other people like Terry Pratchett and Max Brooks and all the other people that I have listed as my inspiration, and give them ideas of, hey, you know, I could take this and I could do it better, or I could take this and run with it in this other way. So I just like the idea of my ideas not being just contained within my own head anymore, and I just did it.
Joel, Tristan?
I got the idea because Tristan emailed me and said, hey, Joel, I want to write a book for role-playing, and you seem like a pretty smart guy, and more importantly, you know different things than I know, so I think it would be synergistic for us to work together. And initially, we talked briefly about writing something involving time travel, but we both decided that would be far too complicated and wouldn't actually make all that much sense, and so we went with Tristan's original idea, which you'll have to ask him how he got it first, of putting together a collection of interesting people, places, and events and landscapes.
So, Tristan, how did you get the idea?
Well, I'd first like to preface this by saying that I am so grateful that I was able to work with Joel on this, because it's not just that Joel knows very different things from what I do. That is very true. It is a huge help in a project like this. But there's also the psychological benefit of the knowledge that you are working with someone else. I don't think either of us would have been able to get this project to completion without the other. If you're at home thinking about trying this sort of project, personally, in my experience, I would recommend getting a co-author, because it was a huge help for us.
Let's talk about the subject. This one, I'm not going to pitch to any particular person. I'm just going to kind of leave it open. I think one of the traps a lot of people fall into, and I've fallen into this trap many times myself, is you've got an idea, you've got chapter one, you've got some kind of an outline or a draft or a start of it, but that's as absolutely far as you've gotten. And let's talk about that. What did you guys have to do to get done, to get this finished? What was the catalyst there?
For me, the catalyst was that I'd had this idea in sort of an unfinished form in my head for a few years, ever since I had come across something in Dragonlance where the PCs were going to go to this area of the map, and there's words on the map. It says the Great Moors. Well, what the heck is a moor? I don't know. You know, fine, you can just look up more on Wikipedia, no big deal. But more importantly, if the PCs are in a moor, what do you see? What do you smell? What sort of adventures can happen there? That was there in my head, and then it catalyzed somewhat embarrassingly because I had graduated from college, I was trying to join the Navy, and I had several months to kill. I wasn't employed, and I wanted to do something productive with my time, so it's, well, golly, I could write a book. Hey, Joel, do you want to write a book with me? So for me, free time was the catalyst.
But you guys also talked about the importance of a co-author. And that's one that I want to kind of harp on for a second, because of the fact that I have found it something that I have to have. That if I have no form of accountability, that if I do not have somebody checking in on me, somebody that I am responsible to, it will never, ever, ever get done. John and I had a fairly lengthy series of heart-to-hearts about 2 or 3 months ago about what it took for each of us to complete creative projects. And I won't speak from his perspective, because he's here and can do that himself just fine. But speaking from my own perspective, I went down the list of things in my life that I had gotten out the door. The serial fiction, the stuff that I used to do for Mech Force North America, Fear the Boot, whatever. And then I went down the list of the things that had failed. And I was trying to figure out, what is the difference between these? Why is it that I can keep a podcast going for, now it's approaching its 7th year, but I can't get this project or that project out the door? And what I quickly noticed in describing all of them to John that was different about them was a lack of accountability. The serial fiction, all I have to do is write 1,000 or 1,500 words. It had a specific deadline. There was an editor and a publisher that were looking for that were emailing me saying, hey, where is this? And once it's out the door, it's now got an audience that's saying, hey, we want the next piece. And so now all of a sudden I'm accountable to the audience. There's what I like to call a continuous feedback loop. There's this pull. The more I put out, the more people pull on it. Fear the Boot's the same way. Once we set this up, I've got other hosts saying, hey, are we getting together this Tuesday to record? If not, are we going to get together Friday to have a party and make it up or something like that? There are listeners out there who are looking for these shows to drop and respond to them and whatnot. And that sense of accountability is really important, which is why in looking at 2013 and some of the creative projects I want to tackle, the short fiction aside, on both of the other two projects I've got in mind, they're both fairly large projects, I have sought out a collaborator on both. Because because I know if I don't have a collaborator, there is no chance I will complete it.
Collaborators are good. There's also another wonderful motivating source that has emerged in the last 2 or 3 years called Kickstarter. Let me tell you from personal experience, I know why Blood Moon Goblins didn't just become something that would be nice to do one day eventually, because I collected thousands of dollars from people who wanted to play it, and at that point I was legally, personally, and morally accountable to actually produce it for them. So yeah, when the demon of doubt started to try to grip my mind once again, as it often attempts to do, I said, hell no, not this time. We've got to put this out the door for people who've already bought it.
Right. You pushed yourself into a corner. You held a gun to your own head and said, yes, look, I don't have a choice anymore. I have to do it.
It was a way
that's exactly what you have to
year
do.
Ago, John was able to hold a gun to the head of 6 months ago, John. So now current John has gotten it done.
Right.
People who study these sort of things, motivation and willpower, tell you to try to find a way to coerce yourself, your future self, because we have non-contiguous visions of ourselves. We see our future selves as different people, which is why it's so easy to assign our own work to them. And we have to find a way to force them to do it.
Exactly.
And crowdfunding and holding yourself accountable to your crowdfunders is one way to do that.
Right, exactly. And one of the other things that I was going to say, in my case, I basically just told a select group of people that, hey, I'm doing this. I want this done. It wasn't just a writer's group, although I was part of the Fear the Boot writer's group thing, or Fear the Writer's Boot, or whatever the hell we called it.
Writer's Guild, that subform.
Yeah, that thing. I was part of that, and that was definitely a big help. Also, I was part of other writer's groups elsewhere in my life that also made me accountable and said, hey, you know, you have a chapter due every week. You know, you don't have a choice for this. You'll fail the class and it'll screw up your GPA for doing this. That is a significant motivator. Like, if for nothing else, then it keeps your head above water, not just in terms of getting your projects done, but it also gives you other, as you say, the moral legal ramifications of not completing your writing. In this case, it's not allowing you to continue or graduate if you don't get your creative writing in on time.
Yeah, and most of the time we don't have that luxury. We don't get an F for not doing something we don't want to do but don't have to. It just never gets done.
Right, exactly. So you have to give yourself some sort of accountability. If it's somebody or something looking over your shoulder and say, hey, look, you remember that dream you had 6 months ago? You remember, is like, remember how you wanted to actually be published? Well, it's 6 months ago now. You had plenty of time to do it, but now you have another 6 months of you have to keep doing it. So kind of the core of all of this is having somebody else helping you help yourself is totally invaluable. Even if you have just a buddy, like a Dan or a writer's group or somebody like that, to say, hey, how's that thing you're working on? Did you get that thing I sent you? Kind of stuff. It's just a little bit of a spark to keep the fire going is all that's really necessary.
Yeah, and individual sources that motivation help just as much as crowd sources do.
Absolutely.
I worked a lot with Dan on Blood Moon Goblins. I worked a lot with Keith Curtis, and I worked a lot with Ruben Smith Zempel. All three of them at different points, Dan especially at the end, were integral in saying, okay, this is good, this could be better, but here's how. All right, it's tied up, it's done, out the door. That made it done. That I couldn't have done it without him.
John, there's something else that I did in working with you, and this is really, I think, more of a commentary on me, because as humans are wont to do, I think I was helping you in the way that I thought I would need to be helped if I was in your situation, which is I gave you milestones.
Yeah, you definitely
Or I worked with you at least to come up with milestones of, we're not going to look at this as a project. I'm not going to tell you, I want to see Blood Moon Goblins finished in a month. It was more like, okay, what are the tasks you're going to take on for this week? Well, you're going to do this, this, and this. Okay, great. On Wednesday, I'm going to say, where are you on that? Then come Friday, I'm going to be like, where is that? And I did that with you. Once again, it's not a commentary on you, but it's because it's the kind of thing I need. You know, I have to break a project down into these bite-sized pieces, because that way I feel like I'm getting somewhere.
Yeah, you have to have measured progress. That was, I don't know how many of you guys read the Bill Gates AMA on Reddit the other day, but it led me to his annual letter. He apparently publishes a letter to the whole world once a year. And his point in the most current one was, you have to have measurable incremental progress to succeed. It's amazing how many projects that have all the resources they need and all the time they need, but don't have a way to measure every step of progress fall apart. Whereas people whose backs are against the wall or are working on a shoestring budget, but nonetheless say, okay, we got 10 widgets out on Monday, we got 8 widgets out on Tuesday, we got 12 widgets out on Wednesday, and keep going one at a time and can see it happen, ultimately keep going and succeed. So you're right about that, Dan. Compartmentalized goals are really valuable.
That was something that was helpful with the nature of our project, because normally it's kind of hard to turn writing into widgets. You know, you can't really see it as blocks of steel or something. But because we could put it as articles, we could, you know, set a goal for we're going to do X articles next week, or we need to do X many articles so that we can have this done by our appointed time.
Yeah. If you got nothing else, you got words. We have measurable building blocks of written projects. Whether we think it's a good idea to evaluate quality by sheer length of production is probably not, but saying, okay,
we're still not a fancy novelist.
Yeah, my book can finally stop a 9mm bullet. I'm going to work on it until it can stop a 223. You can. George R.R. Martin has a lot of money. I mean, it works. Well,
I was about to say, that's not necessarily what I go for, but all right, go ahead.
No, it's not what I go for.
Well, I know John didn't go for that because Blood Moon Goblins is, 49 pages long?
Yeah, I think after indexing, it came out to like 52 or 53.
Yeah, so it's Blood Moon Goblins was certainly not a bloat.
I actually despise door-stopping material. It took me years to get around to even approaching Dresden Files and Discworld, not because any one of their installations is a doorstopper, none of them are, but because collectively they're just so big. It's like, I have only so many stories I can read in my life, and I don't want to spend all this time there. But, you know, you read a handful of them, and every single one of them just delights you infinitely, and you finally get over that and say, okay, fine, this is a gold mine of entertainment. I can be not afraid of it now.
Exactly. You have this giant cannon that is horribly intimidating. C-A-N-O-N, not C-A-N-N-O-N. Right. Although that would also be applicable in some cases.
I don't
think
there's any interest in it, at least not as of the third or fourth novel.
No giant cannons.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Although he should use one since they're very low tech.
Like that giant cannon of information is really tough to get over. And I'm bringing it back to the projects thing. My short story collection is like 160,000 words long. I would not be able to write that in one sitting. I don't think anybody except for like someone that's channeling the ghost of J.R.R. Tolkien. I don't think that they could even channel that much.
And
like,
even he took forever to write his crap. You look back and realize how long he was a writer and an academician and how little he actually produced. And it's almost staggering.
It is extremely staggering. And that is exactly what you have to kind of look for as far as keeping perspective is the word I'm looking for. Is keeping perspective on your project is huge. It is absolutely 100% necessary. Like you're talking about with the compartmentalizing and breaking it down into small, manageable goals of a chapter or a section or whatever. I'm not that disciplined necessarily, but as long as you have that chapter and you have that section or you have that outline, you at least have something for the next time you're sitting down. You have a jumping off point. You have a corner of the puzzle that you have done. You can go back to it later to make sure that there's not something else wrong with it or whatever, but you at least have some momentum going. It is that momentum that is 100% necessary to making a project finished.
In a related vein, the advice I always got from my dad, who's a journalist and author, was if you want to write a book, just sit down every day and pump out 500 words. You can do 500 words in a day, even if you've got a full-time job. It's a very doable amount. If you do 500 words every single day and you stick to it, by the end of the year, you'll have a book. It's that simple.
You'll have a big book by the end of a year if you do it every single day for 365 days. Hell, you can do it in a half a year.
Yeah, that's obviously not including editing, which you would absolutely need unless you are, George R.R. Martin.
No, he needs it. I don't know if he has it, but everybody needs editing.
I agree with that.
I've got editing as a whole subject layer for this episode.
Yeah.
But before we get to editing, as we're sitting here talking about the creative process, I've got a few additional thoughts I want to throw on there. But first, I want to ask you guys each to answer a question. And I'm going to ask you kind of lay your souls bare here for a moment. What's the closest you came to failure? I mean, obviously you succeeded. Every one of you has this product out the door, saleable as of me talking. So you succeeded. But during the course of your writing process, what is the closest you came to failure? What caused you to nearly fail and what kept you from failing? Because I think these anecdotes will be useful to people that have yet to hit those points. And I think if nothing else might be interesting to someone, even if they've got no interest in writing. Who wants to start for me?
Personally, I can think of 2 points we could talk about. First off was during our Kickstarter. Well, first, of course, we had the initial surge of enthusiasm when all our friends and relatives and friends of friends were contributing and saying, oh, this looks interesting. We should contribute and buy a book. And then, of course, it started to slow down and just was crawling along through the middle of the Kickstarter, and it didn't look like we were going to make it entirely. I mean, to some extent, there was a chance, but there was also a big chance we would fail. And then part of what happened was that Monty Cook mentioned us on Twitter, and that got us our largest day of contributions, in fact, was that day, I believe, or at least our highest number of contributors in a single day. So thank you very much, Monty Cook, and that got us through our first problem.
He's a good egg. He's been on the show and I believe diverted significant traffic to our website. So, yay, Monty Cook.
Right. Finally today.
Monty Cook
yesterday.
Does come up with a lot of great stuff. It's true.
I finally yesterday actually got around to writing him a thank you email saying, like, so Monty, thank you so much for doing that.
What about during the writing process itself?
Well, that was the second thing I was going to say, was that really this was my fault. I'd been busy at work and I'd let my writing fall behind. And so I had a bunch of different articles left. And Tristan emailed me and he said, Joel, I have to go and talk to our layout person. And if I can't talk to her now, it'll be a month or so until she's free again for an appointment. And we'll be late on our Kickstarter. So I need your articles. And so I sat down and I had to do a calling survey for work. And so I had to stay till 9 or so. And then I stayed up all night. And I typed, the copy editing had been done by another person, but she had done it all on paper, so I had to transfer those in by hand. And then finally got the stuff sent off to Tristan the next day, and we got the layout through because I was finally not lazy that day and wasn't letting Tristan down. And so we got our project out.
Nice.
Chuck, what about you?
There are many points of failure, to be honest with you.
Yeah, pick one that's the most interesting, one that's the biggest, I don't know.
Probably the biggest single event was getting somebody to read my thing and basically saying, you have like half of a book here and, you know, you're not going to be done for at least another like 3 or 4 years. Like, given the changes this person was looking at, it was going to be like another like several years for this to be in any way, shape or form done. And I just looked at it and I really friggin' lost hope. I tell you what, I was really not looking forward, not because I don't believe in the settings and stories or whatever. It's just that I was like, are you serious? It took me this long to finish this amount, and now it's like,
I just walked from LA to Omaha and you're telling me what I want is in New York.
Right, exactly. And not just that, but not giving me an address and not giving me anything other than, you're not anywhere near done, don't even bother, pretty much. You know, I kind of like looked at that and I was like, you know what, this is horribly depressing. It's like, I'm going to go play video games for a month and a half. And that didn't really help me. So basically what I did, I kind of manned up a little bit and said, you know what, I want this done. So I put together a long, comprehensive list of every little bit of feedback. And because I was looking for work at the time, I basically just said, okay, you're going to get 5 of these things checked off by the end of each day at minimum. And so I did. And I just kept hacking and hacking and hacking at that list and making sure that those edits didn't edit in other plot holes. And I'll get into that later when we get on to editing. But just kept hacking and hacking and hacking at that list until I was like, all right, I'm done with the list. As far as I'm concerned, it's done. And then I just had somebody else look at it one last time just to make sure. And then I was like, all right, now I'm going to put together a new list. And that new list is going to contain the following things. Go on CreateSpace and figure out what they need from me as far as formatting goes. Go on Smashwords and figure out exactly what they need as far as formatting goes. Contact one of my artist friends and make them make me a cover. And once I got that list checked off, I was like, all right, I have no more excuses. There are no more things on this list. There are no more things I need done. Therefore, the book is done. So it's basically just getting over the rejection and, as I said, manning up and just making it happen. And it was all a matter of lists, which is, again, goes into my editing process, which is preparing yourself and then preparing to prepare yourself. But that's a whole other topic that I'll get into later.
My moment of doubt and pain came as a direct result of the timeline I put on the Kickstarter, which I don't know if any of you guys also had this problem, but was outrageously overly optimistic and born of my ignorance as of just how much work this was going to be. I thought, okay, I have a pretty robust set of GM notes. You know, I know it's going to take art and layout a while to do, but this is something that's going to be about 50 pages. You know, the raw copy of this is going to take me a month. Well, haha, that is not correct.
Nope.
It took me more like a year.
API.
So I've got this flag flying on my Kickstarter page. It says, oh, yeah, deliverable by, you know, holidays 2011. And it's late summer 2012, and I still haven't released yet. And I just felt cripplingly, paralyzingly guilty about that. And I was starting to attract some understandably irate commentary from some of my backers. And some, most of the commentary was very gentle, very understanding. And once I came out and explained what had happened, everyone was back on board. For a minute there, I was sort of afraid of the project because I had fallen so far behind my initial estimation of what it was going to take that I was handling it with kid gloves and especially right. and going for very long times without even addressing the community at all.
That's really the danger of putting your real name on things.
Yeah.
People can find you if
yeah.
you use
and then
your real
putting
name.
Putting the name of the podcast on it, putting my own professional reputation on it and everything else. And I did that on purpose. I knew ultimately this thing was going to get made. But what I did was contacted Dan and we started a series of more brief measurable goals, kind of what we were talking about, and really heavy editorial collaboration where it was no longer a matter of, okay, just write stuff and then knock it back down until the cows come home or, you know, have this slush pile of art that you bought with Kickstarter money but don't really have any idea of where it goes. It became, okay, this Friday this is done, next Friday that's done, next Friday that's done. Once I got back on the horse, I think it was only a matter of a month or two between right. enough being a vag, this thing dies now, to, okay, it's out, here's the download code.
Making it a mechanical part of your day to put together, saying, oh, okay, I need to accomplish this task, okay, I'm done. I need to accomplish this task, and it's all on a list. It's a lot less emotional, and therefore a lot more likely for it to happen. Is that once you have it on a list and you have it scratched off that list, it's like, oh, well, that wasn't so hard now, was it? And then you realize, oh, wait, I've been sitting around for 6 months dreading doing this. It's now done. Now I have no excuse.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Fear of your own creation is what struck me. And I know I've seen other creatives in very similar circumstances.
Yep.
Be facing the same thing. I've seen some of them overcome it. And I've seen some of them succumb to it.
Emotional.
I've seen people who have completed stuff not put it out because of it.
Emotional incapacitation is far more powerful and far more prevalent than, in my, at least my opinion, than lack of skill is. But let me give you guys a little bit of trivia here. If it's not true, and I think it is true because I think I picked this up in one of my psych courses, but even if it's not true, it's still a useful little bit of folklore. Do you know how many times it takes to make something a habit? How many times you have to do something before it becomes a habitual, easy task?
I've heard you have to do it regularly for something like a month or two.
I've heard less than that. I've been told you have to do it twice. You do something twice, and the third time is easy. Something is only hard to do twice. It is
okay.
By the
I've
third,
had people being lying to me for like a decade then. Seriously. I've heard everything from you have to do it for a month to like 6 months. And if you fail even once, even do the things outside of your control. And I was like, wow, why should I even bother? Why should I just not? Why should I have to do that? But I understand why now.
That's the flip side to it, though. That's the negative side to it. If you sit down one night and write 500 words, and you sit down the next night and write 500 words, by the time you go to sit down the third night, it's actually going to feel a lot easier to do in all probability. But that works the other way around. Let's say there's a day where something comes up, you're busy at work, an emergency happens in the family, whatever it is, you get in a fight with your spouse or one of your friends, and you're just not in the mood, and you miss that day. And then there's a video game that looks interesting on the second day. And then that video game looks interesting on the third day. And you have created the negative habit just as quickly as you created the positive habit. And that's something you have to be real careful of. And I found that in my own life, that if I miss something once, okay, not a big deal. If I miss it twice, now I'm probably in trouble. But along those lines, something else that I cannot emphasize enough is don't be your own worst enemy, because you probably already are. If you miss something once and beat yourself up over it, what you have done is you have taken the emotional bank that is tied to this project and you have just filled it with garbage. You have just put crap in it that doesn't belong in there. And your subconscious emotional association with this project is going to be a negative one. When you think about that project, you are going to think about failure. You are going to think about missed deadlines. You can't do that to yourself. If you screw up, fine. You screw it up, put it behind you, get back on the horse and do it right. What happened in the past is unchangeable. Don't let that become a part of how you think about yourself and the way that you function.
Total mind over matter. Absolutely mind over matter.
What's interesting to me is that in this whole conversation about motivating yourself to write and get this product out the door, everything I'm hearing is almost word for word identical to how you motivate yourself to exercise. You know, it's the same process.
Which I have no idea how to do.
Well, I think maybe you do, because now you know how to motivate yourself to write, and it seems to be the same process.
Yeah, but I actually care about my writing. I don't care about how fat I am. I know I'm going to die. I can at least leave something behind other than a stinking, bloated corpse.
You could leave a nice, good-looking corpse.
Yeah, you leave a sexy corpse.
It's going to be it's going to be bloated and fat no matter what I do, so eventually.
Right. Actually, what it reminds me of is programming. This is how I approach code. I mean, I have spent far more of my life writing code than writing prose, which is both a neutral reality and perhaps a negative statement on where I'm at with some of my creative projects. But I've been professionally employed as a programmer now for over 15 years. And I've been programming as a hobby literally since I was 6 years old. That is not a joke. One of the things that I have learned from all that experience is you sit down, you come up with manageable milestones. You pursue each one of them. You manage change with reasonable expectations. You give yourself some wiggle room. You don't beat yourself up over the failures. You get it out there. You go back and you fix it. And you have a reasonable view of success. And this is going to lead us right into editing. There is no such thing as an unbreakable program. There's no such thing as an unhackable system. It doesn't exist. Forget about it. What you try to do is your due diligence. There's a saying by Voltaire, which has been given to me multiple times. It was at one point in my SIG line on the forums, and I think I've used it on the show before, which is the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Which I think I dropped on you while I was wasted on an airplane.
I believe that is correct. John and I totally both have this weird quirk where our IQs go up the more we drink. For most people, they go
about that.
But it does for me. Tell me it's not true. I start drinking, my vocabulary gets bigger, my thoughts get deeper.
I'm certainly more forthcoming with my thoughts when I've had four. But yeah, we just sat next to each other with nothing but gin and tonics and the ability to converse about life. And this sort of thing happens.
Yeah. But the perfect is the enemy of the good. There was a point when I was sitting there editing my own short story for this anthology that I'm doing with Riley. And as I was working on it, I had already had the concept checked by Carla. I gave her the first pass and I just said, I'm not asking you for edits, because she was kind of busy with work stuff. But I just said, can you just tell me, does the story work at all? And she came back and said, yeah, I changed this or that, but overall it works. And I then passed it from there to Laura Anderson, who's a professional editor. And she did a great job. Scott Bonner, who did a great job. I also gave it to Beth, Past's wife, and she edited it for me. And they had given me all their edits and I'd incorporated them. And I still had, but maybe a week left before deadline. And I spent those last few days just rereading it and rereading it and nitpicking it and nitpicking it and nitpicking it. And finally, like an anvil dropped in a cartoon, that truth hits me. of the perfect has become the enemy of the good. I'm going to nitpick this thing either until A, I chicken out and don't deliver it, or B, it's like metal fatigue. You can bend a paperclip back and forth, and that's okay. You do it enough times and eventually the paperclip breaks. And if I play with this story for too long, I'm going to make it worse, not better. And I forced myself right then. The analogy that I gave these guys prior to recording was, I said, it's like jumping from a tall place. If you think about it, you won't do it. You just have to do it. So right then and there, I closed down Word. I opened up an email. I attached it and I hit send. And boom, it's gone. It's over. I can't keep toying with it.
Yeah, it's not yours anymore. It now exists somewhere else, so you have to move on. And that was kind of one of the points that I wanted to make, was you do have to leave your stuff behind. Once you're done with it, it's done. It's in somebody else's hands now. Yeah, you're responsible for the content, so if you, like, threaten the president or something in it, that's one thing. But if you didn't, if you just wrote a story where people are just going to read it and consume it and kind of go on with their lives, it's okay if they find a typo on page 397 of 596. You'll live, they'll live, unless they have some sort of severe brain aneurysm.
Well, and so, I think that right there, Chuck, is an important truth, which is not only do you have to be able to let go of it after it's done, but prior to it being done, you have to have a reasonable understanding of what it means to be done. You have to be able to say, look, this is the point where it is finished, and I'm not going to keep toying with it. It will never be as perfect as I want it to be, but I have to let go of it once I hit this point. And you have to have that image before you get there, because if you don't, you will get there and you will never let go of it.
Right.
You will hold on to it, trying to squeeze it into this perfect shape. And I feel vindicated in the end. And I'm going to talk more about editors themselves here in a moment. But this is really a praise to my editors more than myself. But the short story that I wrote comes in at just under 8,000 words. And I sent it over to Riley, and Riley passed it off to his own editor to look at. His own editor came back, and the comment, and I don't know if it's a he or she, so I'll just say he, but his comment on my story was, he said, I feel like I'm not doing my job because in 8,000 words, I only found one mistake. There's got to be something I'm missing, you know, or something to that effect. And that's the point, is, you know, one mistake in 8,000 words, that's what I got it down to. And I was still toying with it when I hit send on that email.
Yeah, I'm so there with you. That was exactly what I was doing. Like, I made changes the day I sent it up to Smashwords for them to do the processing to turn it into an ebook. I made changes that day because I realized, oh wait, I misspelled somebody's name and it didn't get caught by the spell checker. And I'm glad I checked that, but at the same time, there is not a writer in history that has ever not made any mistakes. Even if it's something that is a subjective thing of, oh, there's a better word choice here, or, oh, there's too many commas in this sentence or whatever. It's legal, but it's not right. You know what I mean? Stuff like that. No matter how much you polish something, eventually you're going to polish past the point of being a diamond and into the point of being gravel. You're going to run into a point where all the polishing in the world will just make it worse or make you feel worse about it, because all you'll be doing is focusing so much on the minutiae that you won't step back and say, oh, hey, you know, I have a really great forest here. Maybe there's some dirt on the floor. Who cares? It's a beautiful forest. Yeah, no, I'm totally there with you, Dan, on that. As far as, you have to be able to not just kill your darlings, but you have to be able to kind of let it go and say, all right, today is the day. It's done and gone now. I feel better now that I've released my stories, because now I can go on to other stories. That's the thing, isn't it? It's like, just because you release one project doesn't mean that's the only project you will ever do ever.
Sure.
It releases you to be doing other things, to be creating new worlds and new stories and meeting new interesting people. Or in the case of John, finding new horrible monsters to turn into reasonable human beings, and, you know,
kick
them off of cliffs for a variety of interesting reasons.
They start as Pathfinder or D&D campaign characters, and then they just become whatever they want.
Exactly.
I'm doing it now with Undead.
Oh, man. Whenever you put up that Kickstarter, I want to know about it.
I haven't thought about doing a Kickstarter version, but I might. I'm doing a universe right now where it's like, there's the traditional Count Dracula vampires, and there's sort of a status quo with the good guys, but there's a lich from the ages of yore that's gaining power within them and is about to displace them. So, like, maybe I'll deal with the old guard, sort of understandable undead controllers versus their explosively and mindlessly destructive creations. That could be a good supplement.
So, like, American Gods, but with D&D.
No, the cast of American Gods is more ambiguous. There were some sort of good ones in there. These guys are all jerks, but they're not bathe the world in hellfire forever jerks, which is what the Lich and his crew are.
So. Gotcha. It's my kind of scum sort of
thing. Yeah, exactly. Gotcha. You pay your tribute and I won't just show up and kill you for fun versus I want to kill you for fun right now.
Yeah, and they'll take your money and then kill you for fun and then laugh about it.
Exactly.
And that's definitely a good way to go about it, though.
Yeah, it's the Joker versus Carmine Falcone. It's like, when this comes down, you're siding with Carmine Falcone, whether you like him or not.
Exactly, because the other option is so awful that you can't even... Yeah, definitely a good way of going about it. I would play in that.
I want to move on to editors, but before I do, I want to ask one last question on the topic of editing itself, which is, Joel and Tristan, since you guys had a work that was so heavily rooted in the non-fictional, how did that impact your editing? Because in the case of Blood Moon Goblins, or in the case of Chronicles of Spire, those are both purely fictional, so as long as they're internally consistent. I guess, John, in your case, we had to fact check a few things against Pathfinder rules, but it's not per se that it can be wrong. But when you're writing
blocks can be wrong, that's right. All.
But when you're writing about the historical, something can be wrong. Did that affect your guys' editing? Because you didn't just have to present good text, you had to present accurate text.
I won't say it affected at least my editing. The way we did editing, we had a separate copy editor, but the bulk of the editing was us working on each other's work, where, like, Joel would finish some articles and he would send them over to me and then I would edit them. So we had a guaranteed extra set of eyes on our stuff. When it came to editing Joel's work, I was more than happy to trust that Joel got all the historical stuff right, because Joel's that sort of guy. He knows his stuff, he knows how to research, and if Joel says it's true, I'm more than happy to believe it's true.
Now, there were a couple of articles where initially we were going to present them as something that was totally factual. I remember the Battle of Carensames, where allegedly the Austrian army defeated itself by getting rip-roaring drunk and getting into a drunken brawl, and then pretty soon the whole army was fighting itself into a shambles. The problem is that we looked this up, and I believe I was the one who wrote this one, and I looked it up, and it looked like all the reliable sources said this never actually happened. So I had to sort of reinterpret the article as this became a famous legend over time. And, you know, it's still talked about today as if it's true. This could be something that was started about, say, an empire that people have a reason to dislike. They could be telling this story about that empire in your campaign. A lot of people argue the reason it got started is that the war, the Austro-Turkish war that the battle came from, was very unpopular in the capital of Vienna because it led to the closure of some opera companies due to the economic effects. And so disgruntled opera, out-of-work opera singers were complaining about this and spreading these rumors. And so I figured something like that could be fit into a campaign. But I pretty much trusted Tristan to get the facts right when he did his articles as well. If you see any factual errors in the book, feel free to write us. There shouldn't be any, but go ahead and let us know.
Send them to Chris at fearthemood.com.
Yeah, send them. Along with your furry porn. I didn't know you guys have,
how many more memes we can get into this conversation.
You guys have a little bit of wiggle room there because of the fact that, at least since it's meant for a fictional use, it's not a textbook. If something's a little bit off, but still a compelling story, I think you guys have a little bit of wiggle room in there. I can think of things like the Charge of the Light Brigade or the Christmas Day Truce, which have some basis in reality, but they're popular tellings. The Battle of Thermopylae is another one. What actually happened versus how people think it went down is a little bit different, but it's still useful, I think, as kind of a starting point for certain bits of fiction.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.